Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You can envision a future where, you know, people are actually putting power on the grid, benefiting from it, like in Denmark the other day, as you mentioned. You know, these kind of more distributed forms of energy can also be more resilient, kind of like, you know, thinking about how the internet is distributed. You know, if power is distributed in the same ways, it's a lot harder to imagine blackouts and brownouts. It really means, sharing more financial resources.
That's the voice of Ben West from Tanker Free BC. On this week's show, we speak to Ben about transit referendums, increased tanker traffic, LNG plants, and of course climate change, where we've seen increased foggy and smoggy skies from raging forest fires around BC. So stay tuned.
Swim 1,000 miles to reach the shores of Emerald Isles, with salmon spawning by the million, herring spawning by the billion. Gather with our pods again, the summer food, the summer friends, to raise our babies safe and free. We gather in the Salish Sea. Oh, hush, hear the swish of the boats on the water, the hollowed out cedars, the sons and the daughters, the rhythm of paddles caressing the water, the rhythm of paddles to come greet the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, the thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. I hear your song from many miles, your distant thoughts, your distant smiles. Today we fish in different bays, tonight we meet again to play. Oh, hush, hear the swish of the boats on the water, the great sailing ships with sons and the daughters, the wind and the wood as it cuts through the water, the wind and the wood sailing out to the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. Oh, the coal ports, the freighters, the deafening noise overtaking the water, the deafening noise overcoming the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory with thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great sailor's sea. Oh, from both sides of the border, the rallies, the blockades, the brave sons and daughters, the people speak out for protecting the water. The people are rising to come save the orca.
That's the amazing song, The Great Sailor Sea, by the same album, The Great Sailor Sea, by a local artist, Dana Lyons from Bellingham. Online, I have Ben West. He's the executive director of Tanker Free BC. Ben's been previously working for Forest Ethics Advocacy, the Wilderness Committee, where he distinguished himself as a community organizer. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, before we get to tanker traffic on the Burrard Inlet or the Sailor Sea, we live in a region with major traffic congestion, and we're expected to grow by 1 million over the next 25 years. Yet people voted no overwhelmingly in the recent transit plebiscite. Your thoughts on the logic of having this kind of plebiscite for critical public infrastructure needs, and where do we go from here as far as transit improvements?
Well, I was pretty disappointed with the outcome of the transit referendum, although not particularly surprised given the kind of reaction that I got from folks in the community as we, tried to advocate for transit improvements. I think many people were quite frustrated that there even was a referendum. In the midst of the referendum happening, there was a major provincial government announcement around highway expansion and spending on roads. Nobody was ever asked to vote on that. Many other major infrastructure projects, that's the case. You know, when it comes to public transit, I think most people would agree that this is just a basic service of of a municipal, provincial, federal government spending. So to be put in the position to choose between increased taxes and transit, just felt a bit staged, a little bit like more of a public relations effort from a government who has really hung its hat on balancing a budget, knowing that it needs to spend money on transit, but yet not wanting to sign off on the expenditure. So where does this leave us? I think we're basically in the same position we were, except we're even more behind the eight ball. We, are faced with a lot of people moving to the region. That number might even be low. If we look at the potential impacts of extreme weather events and climate change and instability around the world, this is a very preferable destination for many people. And we're going to need public transit, not just for the convenience of people, but, the choices we make in terms of transit investment or transportation planning has huge implications for land use patterns, has huge implications for the future of this region. And I really fear that if we don't make the right decision soon, this could be very bad for the future of the agricultural land reserve and really have big negative impacts on our land use patterns and really the sustainability of this region overall.
Now, I've been speaking with a lot of people since the no vote, and they're very disappointed also, and they state that this is kind of the provincial government passing the buck when this should be in the Ministry of Transportation, just like BC Ferries should be governed and accountable directly to the province, and they seem to be putting these quasi-organizations between them and accountability. What do you think of just trashing TransLink and putting it back in the Ministry of Transportation?
Yeah, well, I think this was, in a lot of ways, a referendum on TransLink. I was a bit torn about my feelings about it. Yes, I wholeheartedly agree that it should be run by, the region's mayors. There should be an elected and appointed or accountable board. The steps that have been taken to sort of dismantle any government oversight at the local level has, really been a big step in the wrong direction. And I haven't liked, many of the decisions made by TransLink. I also felt like in some ways those who made this a referendum on TransLink were basically biting off their nose despite their face. It was, still the case that we needed transit badly. And there's plenty of opportunity to unpack what was going on with TransLink. As much as I wasn't crazy about the question itself, the fact that we needed transit remained, and I thought we could sort of deal with some of the problems of the referendum, after all this was said and done. I mean, taking a larger look at our tax infrastructure, the state of our crown corporations, what's private, what's public in this province, there's a lot of problems there. There's a lot to be looked at, and TransLink, I would put far from the top of the list of priorities, yet I would put transportation planning and action on climate change firmly at the top of that list.
Speaking about climate change, you're head of a group called Tanker Free BC. Now, Kinder Morgan currently has tankers that go through the Burrard Inlet, but your group is opposed to the pipeline expansion. Can you explain the scope of what this expansion would mean for tanker traffic through the Salish Sea?
Well, if Kinder Morgan has its way, not only will they build a new pipeline equivalent in size to the Enbridge pipeline along the route of the existing Trans Mountain pipeline, which was built over 60 years ago, largely for the sake of servicing the needs of British Columbians, but we would actually see an increase from the current state of somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 tankers a year up to well over 400 tankers a year. It's important to note that, that number was as low as 20, 25 tankers a year before Kinder Morgan bought the pipeline. We've already seen increases from a redistribution of what's going through that pipe, which has resulted in even more coming in by train and by truck. Kinder Morgan's intent is quite clear. They want to turn the west coast of Canada into a major gateway to the Asia Pacific. They want to take advantage of access to those markets, and right now they're one of the only major points where tar sands oil is making its way onto international markets, and of course that's got huge implications for not only the safety of our region but also for climate change overall.
Now, Ben, when I was doing some research for this interview, I came across a letter, an open letter on the internet addressing you from the Chamber of Shipping, and they had a few points, and I'll read a couple. They said improvements to design and construction have dramatically improved the safety over the last 25 years of tanker traffic. And now tankers are double-hauled, precision navigation. These are kind of commercials we see from Enbridge. How do you address these points that things are just much more safer now and the systems are better built?
Well, I mean, first of all, great. I mean, this is absolutely what we need for the existing traffic. It's not an argument for increasing traffic. Basically, it's a set of arguments that's fundamentally ecologically illiterate if you're living in the age of climate change. And to say that we're not going to spill as much oil into the inlet, and nobody can promise you that there will never be an oil spill, double-hulled tankers are no guarantee. All you have to do is Google the words double-hulled tanker oil spill, and you'll find plenty of examples of where that's happened. Nobody's immune to human error. Weather conditions can have huge impacts, and, simply putting an extra layer of metal between you and a major catastrophe is far from a guarantee. But that being said, I for one, I'm quite happy that we've seen, increased focus on safety as a result of this conversation. And, the fact that, groups like that are writing me letters, tells you that that they really do have a public relations problem on their hands because people are concerned about oil spills. But, the fact remains that, even if we didn't drop a drop of this oil into the inlet, the end result of this project going ahead as planned would be big increases in our contribution to global warming. And, we just simply live in an age where that's not acceptable and, would put us firmly on the wrong side of history in my perspective.
Currently, out in Newfoundland, the premiers are meeting and talking about a Canada-wide energy strategy. And I think back to the last provincial election when Adrian Dix said that they wouldn't expand Kinder Morgan. A lot of people say he paid a price for that. Can you address this fear that many people have that if we restrict our resource economy in some way, if we restrict resource exports somehow, our economy is going to tank? I guess the environment versus economy argument. Can you speak to that?
Well, a few things to unpack there. I mean, first, I don't think it's true that that Adrian Dix paid a price because of his Kinder Morgan statement. I think the way he dealt with that announcement left a lot to be desired. I mean, for anybody who remembers it, it was not the clearest announcement, and the next week was followed by explanations and follow-ups and, you know, statements that basically sounded anything like a firm commitment or a principled stance, and really looked a lot more like just kind of naked politics, an attempt to sort of win votes away from the Greens, who are, you know, very popular in ridings that were also important to the NDP. But I mean, I felt like one of the biggest problems the NDP really had in that election was actually just a lack of vision. You know, they really didn't roll out much of a platform. You know, they didn't really talk about where job creation would come from under their government. And, you know, for anybody who's following these issues closely, I mean, there's actually more people in the United States today working in solar power than working in coal. You know, the number of jobs that are created by these pipelines, I mean, yes, there are jobs in the construction phase, but there's lots of different things that can be built that create jobs. And in the long-term operation phase, you know, they actually don't create that many jobs. They create a tremendous amount of risk, and that risk is not only a risk to our ecology, but it's also a risk to, you know, our tourism business, to the brand of Vancouver or British Columbia as a beautiful destination location. You know, that has implications for real estate, for, you know, the whether capital is invested here from overseas, for any number of different businesses. And at the end of the day, the resource sector, I mean, you know, to be fair, does create some good paying jobs for people upstream in Alberta. But, you know, by and large, it's not a large portion of the economy of British Columbia at this point. You know, the days where this was our major source of employment is behind us. You know, there's more people working in construction, working in retail, working in high tech. And, you know, we could go much further in that direction. You know, what I would have loved to have seen from, you know, from the NDP or really from any government is some focus on doing anything other than just basically pulling as much out of the ground as they can and selling it raw overseas. And, you know, it's a pretty unimaginative approach that we see from our current government. And, you know, and that ultimately really needs to change. There's many jurisdictions in Europe and elsewhere in the world where, you know, there's much more vision, where there's a plan that's not only responsible for the environment, but also creates many, many jobs that are the kind of jobs we can all be proud of. And, you know, I think Canadians are very capable and desirous of that kind of a role in the world and those kinds of jobs. I think it's a shame that this is so often framed as a competition between jobs and the environment, because truth be told, it's really about the power of, you know, some relatively wealthy individuals to maintain the status quo, you know, and that really has a negative impact on all of us.
Speaking of which, I just read this week in Denmark, they're creating 140% of their electrical power needs from wind power. So they have all the energy they need, plus they get to sell 40% of their excess power. Now, speaking of kind of going the wrong direction, Christy Clark this week has announced an historic agreement pinning our future on LNG, which is really fracking. She won't say the word fracking. Can you talk about fracking and the potential risk, long-term risks and disaster that this could result in?
Well, industry is always quick to point out that that fracking or hydraulic fracturing is a relatively old practice. I mean, we often talk about it as if it's brand new, and there is some truth to the fact that it's been happening for a long time, but never on the scale that we're seeing today. I mean, basically, this just means the injection of steam, chemicals, water deep underground to try to create fractures in shale formations or other underground rock formations to help us access the harder-to-access oil, gas, you know, that's underground. And basically, as we've run out of the easy-to-access kinds of oil and gas that just basically bubble to the surface, you know, when you strike a hole in the right place, you know, we've now gone to greater and greater lengths using more and more expensive technology, more and more groundwater, more and more chemicals. And they're basically doing, you know, dangerous experiments, you know, with rock formations that, you know, have been shown to result in earthquakes. You know, something like half of the chemicals that are pumped underground are well known to remain underground and will sit in aquifers. And, you know, of course, this is tied to things like people lighting their tap water on fire and farms that are located close to these operations. And, you know, any number of other potential problems that, you know, are the end result of doing stuff that has really not been done before on this scale, using chemicals, you know, that really shouldn't be anywhere close to agriculture or to human bodies, let alone wildlife, that, you know, will not only affect wildlife, but could work its way up the food chain and affect us ultimately. So, I mean, this is really, to a certain extent, a form of desperation. I mean, as we try to cling to the fossil fuel economy, we're going to greater and greater lengths, whether it be, you know, offshore oil drilling that goes deeper and deeper underwater or in the Arctic, you know, mountaintop removal, coal mining, where we're literally just blasting the tops off mountains, or fracking for oil and gas, which is, you know, yet another example of kind of the extremes that we'll go to try to, you know, uncover fossil energy. And of course, with that, you know, these extremes comes also a much higher price for the extraction. And meanwhile, the price per unit of energy for renewables is only going down. So, I mean, not only is it dangerous, but it actually just doesn't make good economic terms in the long term, but actually even really in the relatively short term.
Yeah, I wish we could have direct democracy in some of these big decisions that seem so foolish instead of the decisions that are so vital to us, like having good transit. Now, we're going through a major drought in British Columbia. We have forest fires galore. I was on the Sunshine Coast a couple weeks ago, and I woke up and there was ash all over my car. It was pretty awful, and California is going through a historic drought. Can you talk about some of the opportunities with climate change to transition, and not only will improve our planet, but improve our economy and lives?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely we are experiencing climate change, you know, and we're seeing it and feeling it in ways that many of us didn't even really anticipate. You know, I think for many of us, when we thought about climate change years ago, it wasn't necessarily a picture of, you know, Vancouver covered in ash and with smoke so thick that you couldn't, you know, see that far ahead of you. You know, the Vancouver in the last week or so, you know, looked like the pictures of Beijing that we all react to in terms of air quality. You know, and hopefully this is the kind of thing that leads people to wake up. I mean, everybody from the Pope to the Pentagon is talking about the need to transition off of fossil fuel dependence and the ability to get there. I, for one, am pretty excited about, you know, what that can mean, although, you know, I think it's important that we don't get too excited just about technology, because technology isn't going to do everything we need. You know, obviously we can't just shop our way to a more sustainable world. That being said, you know, moving away from internal combustion engines would be a very big step in the right direction. The technology to do so is already quite mature. Big steps are being taken in the direction towards the price of lithium-ion batteries going down. You know, we're seeing the price for, you know, not only solar and wind going down, but, you know, also geothermal is becoming more and more attractive and has huge potential. You know, no matter what we do, it needs to be done, you know, safely. And of course, all energy has a footprint, you know, through the power lines, the staging grounds, you know, and the projects themselves, you know, in terms of manufacturing and the deployment itself. That being said, you know, one of the things I find really promising about, you know, the future, you know, coming from more renewable sources is that, generally speaking, this means a more distributed form of energy production, which really can be quite empowering to local communities. Instead of being, you know, sort of the victims of what the oil and gas sector decides to do in their backyards, you know, you can envision a future where, you know, people are actually putting power on the grid, benefiting from it, like in Denmark the other day, as you mentioned. You know, these kind of more distributed forms of energy can also be more resilient, kind of like, you know, thinking about how the internet is distributed. You know, if power is distributed in the same ways, it's a lot harder to imagine blackouts and brownouts. And, you know, it really means, you know, sharing more financial resources. I mean, if that money is coming back to many more hands and not all concentrated in one place, you know, this really can mean serious benefits for communities, for individuals, you know, things like farmers who struggle to make ends meet in today's day and age. You know, we're already seeing farmers being some of the earliest adopters of solar and wind technology, you know, simply because it's a way to generate income. And for low-income people, you know, it's good to see this focus in the United States with a, you know, bill passed recently, which, or an initiative, I should say, coming from the president that, you know, really focuses on trying to make solar available to low-income people, low-income communities, to try to help reduce bills for folks, you know, who, you know, their energy bill is a big portion of their income. and really to make sure that that everybody's part of the conversation when it comes to the future of energy, not just those who can afford it.
Now, Ben, you are on a tour, Tanker-Free BC Tour right now. Can you tell me about the tour and the response you're getting from people up and down the coast?
Well, we've been going up and down the coast in a solar-powered catamaran. It's a sailboat, so it can, of course, do the majority of the work just by the wind. But we've just installed a bank of solar panels on the top of this boat, like just on either side of the mast, facing up towards the sun, of course, and have banks of batteries in the pontoons on either side on this catamaran. It's got two Torquedo electric motors on it, which are about the equivalent of a 9.9 horsepower engine on the back of either of the pontoons, just outboard motors. It's a pretty remarkable boat, and I mean, really, the idea was to highlight the viability of some of this technology, to meet with people on public docks in various locations in the Lower Mainland and the Gulf Islands and Vancouver Island. And it's really just the beginning of a longer conversation, I think. But we're trying to reach beyond the so-called usual suspects who show up at rallies and really find folks who maybe we haven't been talking to, who are mariners or down at the public docks or walking around in the downtown area around the docks and just kind of engaging people in conversation. One of the really special parts of this tour has been traveling with a young musician by the name of Luke Wallace, who's been, performing at the public docks, in public parks, and also at events that we've set up in various locations. So it is a pretty neat opportunity just to go out and be part of, our beautiful coast and to really celebrate it. There's also going to be a lot of pictures and video that have already been captured and will continue to be that are going to be turned into a film of some kind that we're going to tour around with, along with a presentation to really share, what our experience is like, the people that we talk to, and some of the tangible examples of solutions and alternatives, that we're encountering in so many different places around the Salish Sea.
Thank you so much for the work you do, Ben, and spreading the word. And there's so many Vancouverites who want to transition and have a cleaner, healthier world. So any final thoughts before we let you go on citizen empowerment? And if someone's wondering, this problem's too big, where do I start? Any final thoughts on how people can engage?
Well, I mean, there's so many different ways to get involved, and everybody has different skills and different talents. I would say that, if you have to push yourself a little outside your comfort zone to get things done, one thing that I'm actually pretty excited about is an initiative we've started called the Great Climate Race, which is a fundraiser for local solar energy projects. The idea is a 10K and a 2K walk or run around Stanley Park on November 8th. And the idea is just to give people an opportunity to do something meaningful. I mean, everybody wants to do something for climate change. This is a way where you can raise money, get involved in something very positive, very solutions oriented, and real tangible. When you're finished the event, every step you've taken in it will have helped take us a little step closer to sustainability, and will help spread awareness about what's possible. So would love people to get involved in that. I think it's a very positive and easy place to start, and it's a great way to get to know other people who also want to do work for the better. And I think that's really ultimately what it's going to take is us all meeting to each other and, figuring out how to support each other so we can all get where we need to be.
Thank you so much, Ben, for the work you do and for spending a few moments with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources.